So yeah.
Mike, it's good to be here with you.
Good to be with you too, Andy.
Yeah, love the new music. There's just some gorgeous arrangements.
Thank you.
Tunes. Let's just start with the big picture and
sure.
Tell me about... well, let's start with the East Coast, the East-West setup for this and sort of how those two different geographical locations speak to you in terms of this music.
Well, sure. I think this has kind of been a theme. I released a record about 20 years ago called Two Coasts, and it had a band on the East Coast that was Rachel Z and James Genus and Ronnie Holmes, and the West Coast was Steve Smith. And I believe it was Peter Barchet and John Arbour. And it was those were, you know, the East Coast band had been my working band in New York, and the West Coast band was my working band at the time in the Bay Area. And I think that the theme of this is that I have always been, had both coasts in my heart and come by them honestly. I come from three generations of New Yorkers. My mom's from the Bronx. My parents fell in love and met in Manhattan. They were social workers. And they moved out to the West Coast because my dad got a gig at the University of British Columbia. And so I grew up in Vancouver, Canada. But the truth of the matter is that I will always have both coasts deeply in me. I lived on the East Coast, primarily New York, for about 15 years. Left home when I was 18. And so I remember I was studying with this wonderful composer, Robert DiDomenica, great composer with Gunther Schuller and all these folks. And he said, you know, at the time, I sounded very New York as a player. And he said, you need to get some Vancouver back into your playing. And so I think for me, it's always been a negotiation because both sides are in me.
Yeah.
And to this day, I think I can tend to get pigeonholed one way or the other. I've noticed that recently I did a gig with Peter Horvath, and we had a really nice time. And he said, yeah, it was interesting. Somebody came up to me afterwards and said, I didn't know Mike could play pretty. And I thought to myself, have you ever been to a gig of mine?
Right.
You know, have you ever heard a record? Yeah. I mean, but I think that people tend to say, well, you're one or the other, mm-hmm. and I'm both. And so what I wanted to do was make a recording, and I had all this big band music I had written, and I wanted to make a recording that reflected both of those feelings. And you know, for lack of a better term, there's kind of a more of a sense of, quote, urgency and intensity in the New York style players and recordings, and always has been. And there's more of a sense of contemplation and space in the West Coast style. And so I tried to pick material that I thought would fit both styles. Not that there aren't plenty of folks out here who can play intense, and not that there aren't plenty of folks in New York who can play pretty and beautiful, but I just wanted to represent those two sides of myself, that hoping that my musical sensibility would help those two sides join mm-hmm. a little bit.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about that, because in some ways, as I'm listening to it, I feel like those coastal sort of the stories we sort of tell, the history of those coastal ideas, is present in some ways, but also track by track, I also sort of feel like it kind of defies that.
That's
I mean,
right.
That, you know, that it is not like, oh, the more lush, you know, the West Coast, the more lush and melodic and lyrical, the East Coast more, you know, tough and hard hitting.
Right.
That there's both of those are reflected on both with both ensembles.
I agree with that, and I think because both of those things are always in me, you know.
Yes.
So like when I hear a remark like the one I heard, it just makes me laugh because I'm saying, I don't think you've ever come to a gig of mine if you would say that. It's I think they're in all of us in greater or lesser degrees, but I would not be satisfied with just doing nothing but hard burning swinging music, and I wouldn't be satisfied with just doing lush sonic landscape. So yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, they're both in both elements are in both bands for sure.
So it feels like there's sort of other sort of conceptual frameworks happening on these album on this project that have been reflected on previous recordings. And I'm thinking, I think most recently Originals for the Originals,
right,
where I feel like that sort of concept is very present.
Yes.
in this music. And
yes.
Talk a little bit about
well,
that.
Not only that, there's several tunes that I did on Originals for Originals that I ended up turning into big band arrangements for this one, like Breckerfast Club, mm-hmm. Hen House, St. Paul's, just those are just a few, and maybe there may be more. And it's not a radical departure from what I've done before. The difference is that I'm doing it for a big band format, a larger orchestrated out format. So that's what makes it different, I think.
Again, sort of big picture, talk about the role and importance of the Electric Squeeze Box Orchestra in getting to this point.
Sure. Well, for those who don't know, the Electric Squeeze Box Orchestra is a big band that was started by Eric Jacobson back in August of 2014. He asked me to be a part of it, to play lead tenor in the band, and the framework when it started out was that everybody in the band would compose for it. And when I joined, I mean, I really had never been a guy who woke up every morning saying, I want to write for big band. You know, I think, as you know, I'm a pretty prolific composer. I've probably written somewhere around 3,000 pieces of music in my life. You know, it's a problem. But, you know, I haven't written a lot for big band. It's just like, you know, for whatever reason, I tend to write for the ensembles that are available to me to write for. So when I started playing in that band, and I listened to the band. It was a good band, and we had a regular weekly gig at Doc's Lab in San Francisco. Eric encouraged everybody to write for the band. So I started putting my toe in the water, and I started doing arrangements for the band, and it was fun. It was a great way for me to get to workshop. It was like, when you know, okay, if I work on this, I know there's a good band that's going to play it. You really learn, and you learn how to tweak, and you go, okay, that worked, that didn't work, okay, now I understand. So that's why I started writing. So I wrote about 14 or 15 arrangements over 4 years for that band, and this was the result.
Yeah. So are all of these pieces things that you originally brought through, sort of were tested through
the squeeze box?
Yeah, the squeeze box.
I think so.
Yeah.
I believe so in every case. I mean, different things. Like, for instance, at one point, I remember we had Nicholas Beard as a guest artist, and Eric said, does anybody want to write a chart for him? And I liked the way he sang, and my dad's favorite piece of music, or one of them, was Somewhere Over the Rainbow. So I said, well, let me try to take my hand at that. So I wrote, that was an example.
Yeah.
Or the Squeeze Box got asked to be part of a tribute to Sgt. Pepper's a couple of years ago, Joe Bagale put together, and we were asked to do that tune, so I arranged that for the Squeeze Box. And so that's some, but yes, in general, everything kind of came out of, hey, this would be a fun tune to do, and I would do it. And in virtually every single case, they all came out of small group tunes, and that's kind of like, for me, that's really important. Because I feel sometimes, and this is just my view, that with some big bands, there's an awful lot of wonderful frosting and icing, but there's not really any protein in there. There's not, like, where's the tune? I mean, one of the things I love about Ellington is that it always starts with a beautiful tune. And the same thing, Gil Evans always took beautiful tunes and orchestrated them out. And I think that sometimes when I listen, I'll listen to some things and go, that is just so lush and beautiful, but where's the there?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it always starts with a tune. I always starts with a tune.
And then, so in terms of the actual band, when we're talking the West Coast, it looks like there's maybe 70-80% overlap between the Electric Squeeze Box?
I'd say about 50%.
50%,
okay. 50%. Some of it was that some folks were out of town, and some of it was that I just really, like, for instance, I really like my friend Doug Beavers. I really like the idea of him getting into the band. He's the only guy besides me who's both on the New York and the West Coast sessions. I love the way Jeff Massonari plays guitar, and I wanted to get him on there, and so on and so forth. But for the most part, most everybody on the West Coast sessions has at least done some playing in Squeeze Box.
Yeah.
Of course, Jacobson is in it for sure. You know, that makes that sense. Jeff Mars, who's the principal drummer, you know. So, yeah, there's a lot of overlap. I mean, there is some, you know, I do have some guys I really like that I wanted to make sure got on it as well, you know. And there was another nice thing about it, especially the West Coast sessions, is that I think they were like 4 former students of mine on the recording, and that's gratifying too. It was Doug Beavers, Jeff Mars, John Hadamaya, and course, I'm blanking on the fourth. There's another one, too.
Yeah.
Let's see. Anyway, if I can... Who else was it? There was one other.
Is it Rich Lee?
No. Mm-hmm. I guess that's it. Okay. Yeah. Those were the third three. Uh-huh. There were three on the, yeah, on the session. Yeah. But it was just... It's joyful, and I just really like the fact of getting them all on there. And some of my favorite sax players too. I like my friend Dan Zinn and Rob Suddeth on Barry. Those guys they're not regular parts of the Squeeze Box, yeah, but I really love the way they play.
Yeah, you know?
And so I wanted to get them in there. And of course, Sheldon and Larry are veteran Squeeze Box guys with me, and I love the way those guys play as well. Lots of these guys, wonderful. Mike Olmos, I mean, you name it, you know, Dan Fisley. Joe Bagale sings on one tune, and what a great singer he is.
Yeah.
So the West Coast is, I think it's a really nice representation of the West Coast scene.
Well, let's talk about the New York band.
Sure.
Because this is, I know a lot of these players, some I'm not as familiar with.
Sure.
Talk about sort of, yeah, like, are these mostly drawing on, you know, longtime friends, contacts, or there's some younger players?
Yeah, it's a mix. A lot of these people I go way back with, like... Doug Beavers and Mike Holliber and Marco Marcinko helped me put together the New York band.
Uh-huh.
And they're all longtime friends. Marco was Liebman's drummer for like well over a decade. Doug's, of course, the Eddie Palmieri and the Spanish Harlem guy. Mike Holliber I go way, way back with, and he's running the City College program, great composer, piano player. So those three guys kind of... were my main guides to getting folks onto the record. And then some of them I knew. I certainly knew Bruce Williamson and Tommy Morimoto, and I knew Alan Ferber. And of course, I was really lucky to get John Benitez on bass, who's just fantastic. So, and Todd Beshore, who's just a tremendous alto saxophone. He's Christian McBride's lead alto player.
Oh, okay.
And he just does some... Everybody sounds excellent on it. And then Frank Green, I guess, is like the number one call lead player in New York, and he's just a tremendous lead player, and lots of great playing. Chris Rogers, Barry Rogers' son, amazing trumpet player.
Really?
Yeah, he sounds some. There's some cats in there. There's some cats, and it was just pleasurable. I mean, you could do an entirely different band, it would have been equally great.
Yeah.
But it was just really fun, and it was felt like coming home.
Yeah,
you know, in yeah. a lot of ways.
In terms of what tunes you were going to record where, was that totally sort of obvious decisions, or could you have, you know, could Fantasia on Train Changes ended up being a West Coast piece just as easily?
Well, any of these could have been anything.
Yeah.
But I guess I started by doing the East Coast recording, and I tried to pick the tunes that I thought would particularly lend themselves to that, quote, New York East Coast approach. So there's a lot of very hard swinging stuff on there. You know, I think, like, as you mentioned, Fantasia on Train Changes, you know, or Repressions or Hen House and all that. Those are, they could have been done in either coast, but I really liked the approach that band had. And so those tunes got taken care of, those tunes. And so I said, okay, what have I got left? And what I had left tended to be more toward pretty and more toward straight eighth and more toward rock and fusion.
Mm-hmm.
Just ended up being that way, you know. So if you look at it, there's not really anything like overtly swinging on the Big Band West CD, and there's not a lot of sort of straight eighth stuff on the Big Band East. And that, you know, of course, each band could have done either style just fine. It would have been great. But that just ended up being that, I guess I kind of did... like play into that cliche that, yeah, New York's the hard swinging shit, and West Coast is more thoughtful and reflective and straight eighthy, you know, for lack of a better term. But yeah, either of those bands could have done the other material just fine.
Yeah.
You, there's some of these pieces get just reinvented in really wonderful and idiosyncratic ways. So like you take Fall,
yeah,
a tune that, you know, there's just like the iconic recording. It's been interpreted lots of different ways, and I know listening to this, it was sort of like, oh wait, oh okay, I know that, but it was you know, drew me in, made me listen to like, where is this going?
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, talk about sort of Was there a point of departure for that? Something you started with?
Sure, I started with a tune.
With
a tune. Yeah. This is an interesting one in that with just a couple of tweaks, this one uses, like a lot of the tunes, I tend to like get my hands on the harmony and reinvent the harmony and write my own harmony for these things and just leave the melody alone. But in this case, it was the original harmony and the original melody, but I started off with like a real lush chorale thing, just very in outer space, and then we went into kind of like a quasi Afro-Cuban thing that Doug Beavers rips up on, and then when I wrote the melody for it, the melody is loosely interpreted by soprano and trumpet and trombone, and then the second time through, there's this crazy set of counterlines happening, so you don't even find the melody.
Right.
And then the other part of it that was very fun with it for me was that we get into a three-part a cappella horns with drums. Like starts with like the trombones, and it builds to this, adds the saxes with a second counter line, and then the trumpets with a third very hard counter line. The trumpets hated me for that one, but you know, they did it. And then we come back around with the arch form to the beautiful chorale at the beginning, and Chris Rogers plays great on that on flugelhorn.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the idea behind that. And I just, the interesting thing about it is that the melody that everybody knows as the melody to Fall, I have been told, was not conceptualized as the actual melody. That was actually a background part. And what Ron Carter plays was supposed to be the original melody. But I think that boo-doo-doo-boo-boo-doo-doo, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And Wayne is such a miracle writer. You know, he does so much with 16 bars, and it's just I love those changes.
Yeah,
I thought it's one of the great tunes, and just wanted to do a stamp on it.
Yeah. Victor Feldman's Joshua.
Yeah.
A tune. I mean, I know so well, and again, it sort of threw me for a loop listening to this.
Threw some of the people who were playing it for a loop too. Yeah, yeah. I decided to make it like sort of a funky hip hop thing in 7. And then everything was sort of tongue-in-cheek because, you know, in the original Joshua, it's this driving modal thing in 4, and then it goes to 3 for the bridge. So I put it in 7 and then had like a 4/3 for part of it. And then the bridge section, as a tongue-in-cheek, we do it like a slow swing in 4. And I also wanted to put like a drum and bass breakdown into that because Marco Marcinko and John Benitez sound fantastic on that. That was a lot of fun to do. And then... yeah, I like the way that one came out, and once people get their teeth into it, they can play it. Yeah. It takes a minute.
My talk about Châtain Grillé.
Yes, also known as the Christmas song. Yes. Yes, yes.
And that was, again, like, it was sort of like, what? Wait, what's he doing? Like,
well, it's funny because for the longest time I was like, do I really need to give publishing credit for this? So I did a test on my wife, who's not a musician, and she was listening to the beautiful intro on the piano and everything, and the impressionistic start. She said, oh, no, you don't. Then all of a sudden you're like, boo-dee. But she's, oh, yeah, you better. So I said, yeah, that's a Christmas song, no doubt. So that one is one where I kind of turned it into like a sort of ECM meets French Impressionism thing, and none of the original harmonies are there.
Yeah.
But the melody is completely intact on it. And I just think Mike Holliber on piano just plays so beautifully on that. I just wanted like this kind of French Impressionist wash on the piano, and he does it.
Yeah.
But I love that song too. I mean, it's you know, when the Christmas songs come around, the only one I always think, why don't we play that one all year round? That's a great song. That's a great song.
It is.
Really is. And it's probably about the only Christmas song that I don't get tired of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a handful, but that's definitely on the list.
Yeah, there's probably a couple of others, but not many.
Yeah.
Not many.
Yeah.
Frosty the Snowman, I could do that.
Yeah. When I was a kid, did you hear the Bruce Springsteen Santa Claus is Coming to Town was on all the time? Oh. Like, oh no, Bruce, stop. Yeah.
Feliz Navidad.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Talk about Breckerfast Club.
Breckerfast
Club. And how that, I love how that has taken on a new life from, yeah.
Sure. Well, that one is really interesting because it's actually not what it is based upon, the first two lines of it were an impossible Michael Brecker lick that is really hard to play on the tenor saxophone because, you know, he plays this rapid-fire line that goes way up into the stratosphere. And I just thought, you know, the only way I'm going to make myself learn that, because I wanted to be able to execute it, is to write a tune that uses that. So that was the premise. And then I thought, why don't I write a song that is based on fragments of different Mike Brecker solo bits? And that's the melody the saxophones play is all different fragments of Brecker solos pieced together with new harmonies and that. And so that's where that came from. It was my tribute to Mike, and it's I think it feels like something he might have played on harmonically, and a lot that lick came from the second of three quartets for the Chick Quartets, and we all love him and miss him so much. You know, he was such a good and kind man, and in addition to reinventing how people play the saxophone.
Yeah.
So that was my tribute to him. And it's a fun pun, the Brecker Fast Club.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It makes me thinking about Brecker and just realizing just how much I still, you know, player, he's still so present, right?
He's so present.
Yeah.
Well, you remember that great titled Charles Mingus had that if Charlie Parker were a gunslinger, there'd be a whole lot of dead copycats.
Yeah.
You couldn't throw a brick in the 1980s without hitting a saxophone player who wanted to sound like Brecker in New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, it got to the point where I used to describe myself as a reformed Breckerholic because I literally had to stop listening to him, period, for 10 or 15 years because I needed to get his phrasing, because it's such a distinctive way of playing, and I love it, but I didn't want to play that way.
Yeah.
And so for me, you know, I kind of, you know, we all have our influences, and Michael always be in there, but I think sometimes, you know, just even, well, you think about, not comparing myself with him at all, but you think about how Miles chose such a different path from Dizzy deliberately because he says, it reminds me, again, my great composition teacher, Dean Domenico, when he was teaching me, he said, you can't beat Mozart on Mozart's turf. You need to find your own turf.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's right.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was like my love letter to Mike. And that, that also was on Originals for the Originals. Mm-hmm. That was another one that was turned into a big band thing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk the West Coast.
Sure.
And starting with the classic Harold Arlen, Yip Harburg, Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Sure.
Which, it just starts with sort of a blast of beauty, you know.
Well, you know it's that ethereal. I just sort of like da do da do da. Started off with Jeff Massanari. I just had him play these harmonics on it, and then the harmony shifts underneath it. So again, this is a thing where I don't touch the melody, but everything else gets touched. Every change happens. And I wanted, and the thing that made this work for me was that I wanted a guy to sing it the way Joe Bigale sings. I don't know how you feel. I really love it when I hear soul singers singing jazz. There's something about it that seems really earthy and rooted. And Joe is a great soul singer. And so I said to him, I just want you to sing it like you. Don't try to sound like, you know, Mr. Jazzy. Just sing it like you. And I thought he sounded fantastic on it. Really great. And to me, there's this kind of swirling, impressionistic reworking of that one figure that goes throughout almost like a Steve Wright mm-hmm. sort of trip. And I like the way that came out.
Yeah.
It was good. And Joe is just tremendous on it.
Yeah.
Tremendous on it.
Yeah. I hope you guys, it keeps developing because it's a wonderful combination, and to hear him in that setting is...
Well, you know, we have another project that's the next one I'm going to try to get to after this thing comes out, that you wrote about, the John and Paul Reimagined, mm-hmm. and he sings on all of that, and he sounds great.
Yeah.
He's just I love the way he sings. He's a great musician.
Yeah.
That's part of it. You know, he's not just a singer. There's nothing wrong with just being a singer, but he's an excellent drummer. He's an excellent bass player, plays keyboards. You know, he's a
composer.
Yeah, he's a seriously great musician.
Yeah.
So it was great to get him singing on it because that's, you know, that's how I, if I could sing, that's how I would sing. You know.
Weatherwane. This is another piece, Originals.
And actually, it's ironic because I had a band for a while called Weatherwane with John Mader and Matt Clark and Dan Fisley, and we played a lot of gigs. And when I moved to New York, I was such a Wayne guy that Liebman used to tease me, and he nicknamed me Wayne Boy because I was so into Wayne Shorter. I loved him so much. And so I've always, I loved Wayne even when it wasn't fashionable to love the way he played.
Yeah.
Everybody loved the way he wrote, but people didn't used to like the way he played. You probably remember that.
I do,
you
know? Yeah.
And now I'm kind of wondering, why did they not like this? He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think it's because Wayne's stuff is not easily reproducible. He doesn't play a lot of licks. He doesn't, it's very in the moment. And that was very appealing to me.
Yeah.
You know, so compositional, so melodic and all that. But so this song is a tribute to his Weather Report years, Weatherwane.
Yeah.
And so it's got that kind of a feel about it. And I think the band sounds great on that one. Yeah. Like Jeff Mars and Dan Fisley tear it up on that in the rhythm section. And John R. Burr and Max Miller both play great solos on it. So yeah, it's really fun. It's a fun one.
I feel like the Weather Report, especially sort of late latter day Weather Report, I mean, it's, you know, this hugely popular band, and yet people like Wayne got, for all kinds of different reasons, he played less of a role at the end. And I feel like that's part of the, this like not respecting or discounting his playing is because of that. And then the sort of backlash against fusion and all that. And so you have these years of amazing work that ends up being, overlooked.
People want to skip over the fact that he wrote in an electric genre for about 30 years. It really didn't change until the tragedy with his wife.
Yeah.
You know, that's when he stopped.
Yeah.
And he didn't, I had, a bunch of different friends of mine, Rachel Z, Rodney Holmes, they played in his bands. I mean,
it's just some amazing music.
It was incredible music. Yeah. I mean, tunes like The Three Marias and Endangered Species are about as good as it gets.
Yeah.
And yet people, it's very strange. People like to think in categories.
Yeah.
So now that now he's like this revered elder statesman, and everybody like bows down to him. And I like his quartet a lot, but I'm like, you missed a lot of great stuff with him, man. There's a lot of great stuff. I mean, his solo on something like Mysterious Travelers, and that stuff is just, I mean, I think the other thing about Wayne is that because he was so in the moment, you've seen him enough to know that you never knew what Wayne you were going to get. Sometimes it sounded, sorry, Wayne, sometimes it sounded like you hadn't looked at your horn in a while. And then other times you're just like, I remember hearing him when he came through, I think it was in 2005, Zellerbach, and it's like some of the most amazing tenor playing I've heard in my life.
Yeah.
It was just like, he was so, I remember that people told me he told his band, play like you've never played your horn before. That's what the whole thing, play like you're just learning. It was just, he's very conceptual that way.
Yeah.
But just beautiful. But yeah, I mean, there's not enough you can say about Wayne Shorter. And I'm glad that he's finally getting the respect he deserves as a player. I think he got it as a composer forever, but as a player, he always deserved more than he got. He's like, what do you think? People think Miles didn't know what he was doing? He just had this guy by accident?
Yeah.
And you've probably heard, actually, there's a couple of bootlegs where Miles is not on the gig. Like, there's one with Gary Peacock with that band from 66. It's like Herbie and Wayne and Gary Peacock and Tony. And just like Wayne's solo on, like, I think it's on Just in Time. It's just like, you just can't believe it. Yeah. You cannot believe it.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there was some foolish young man who was like trying to make a name for himself by going after Wayne, but whatever.
Yeah. 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 Whatever. That's.
Got to be better things you can do with your life than that.
Absolutely. Wayne is unavoidable.
yeah, it's a good thing. Yes. We're glad there's Wayne Shorter in the world, I think.
Like, talk about Another Prayer. And was that a piece you've recorded before?
No.
Yeah, that's...
No. I have always loved... I mean, for me... For Coltrane, the thing I love about him more than anything is his ballad playing. And I think that people sleep on that sometimes, but it's really, he has such beautiful phrasing and such exquisite sound and unerring instincts. And he played, one of my favorites is I'll Wait and Pray.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took the first bar of I'll Wait and Pray and turn it into something up. So that's like I'll Wait and Pray. And the rest of it is I just went off, where I just followed it where it was going to be as a tone poem. And I like it. It came out well. And I think that that one has totally unintentionally, but there's a little part towards the end of the melody right before the trumpet solo at the end where I realized, oh God, subconsciously, I think I was filtering a little bit of Nelson Riddle's You'll Never Walk Alone for Sinatra in there. It's in there. I didn't even know. And I just, after the fact, I go, oh shit, that's in there. Not overtly, but it's in there. Yeah, and then Mike almost plays a really, really pretty solo on that at the end, on flugelhorn. Yeah. Yet another one for those people who don't know that I can play pretty.
Yeah. So. Well, and then Skylark talking about... I mean, the next... I sort of feel like, boy, it gets... Because it's Skylark and then the Shiva for Shiflet, which
yes.
We talk about. They're both just gorgeous.
Thank you.
And I mean, the Shiva for Shiflet is, I mean, just absolutely beautiful and really moving.
But thank you.
Before we go to talk a little bit about Skylark, because that is a... it's... you know, what can you say? It's one of the most beautiful standards there is.
It is. But,
and you know, it doesn't need much to...
No. No. So that was another one of my father's favorite tunes. And, you know, I was lucky enough that when I grew up, my dad, who was a Depression-era kid, was always whistling that or Willow Weep for Me or things like that or Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. He loved those tunes. Yeah. And I heard those growing up. And... which, you know, not a lot of kids in the 70s did, but I got to hear him. And so I wanted to do that for him. And again, it's the melody's not touched, but the harmony is very much touched. And it's sort of viewed as a two-part setting. The first part is actually inspired by a Paul McCartney tune called Let Him In. Do you remember the drum groove on Let Him In?
Yeah.
But not too many people know that. So what I always do to translate for drummers is I say to drummers, think of 50 ways to leave your lover, Steve Gadd. So they kind of get what I want and do that. And so that's the first part is like that. And it's like a, you know, that part of mm-hmm. Skylark. So I just took that one fragment and again built and had people chase after each other, build, and then into a really sweet trombone chorale on the melody with Doug Beavers playing lead. And then we move back, we bring back into the 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover groove. There's a really modern, cool trombone solo by John Hadamaya. And then it comes back and I do my little bit on the slow, pretty changes again. And then we go back into bring the melody out, and then we go back into that groove at the end, and Sheldon Brown gets to do some on that, and then we end it. Yeah, so it kind of takes you on a journey.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does.
And you're right, that is one of the greatest songs ever written. That is so great.
Yeah, and it's lovely to hear, you know, you do something, just take it and take, you know, and find different, sort of turn it around, find different, you know, aspects of the beauty of it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention that, because I think that to me, if you're going to do a tune, you need to find a way to make it your own. I mean, nobody needs to hear me do Naima just like Train did Naima. They don't need to hear that. There's no way. Again, back to Robert DiDomenico, you need to find your own turf. So it seems to me that you need to find this balance, and hopefully I succeed, where you honor the original, but you also put your own flavor, your own stamp on it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not just like, oh, okay, I guess I'll take your word for it that's Satin Doll, but I have no idea. But on the other hand, you don't want to just like try to just reduce. You need to make it your own. I think that's like if you look at a lot of what just great jazz players in general have done, is they've made it their own. Look what Train did with Favorite Things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that's what Richard Rodgers necessarily imagined when he was doing it.
Yeah. So I find myself, I think about John all the time. John Shiflet, the bass player from, you know, the South Bay bass player who we lost 2 years ago.
Yeah, way too early.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, you know, such a beautiful player. And Kristen Strom is out there, has put together a book of,
I know,
of tunes of his, which a lot of it music I hadn't even heard before, because yeah. You know, and so this is a beautiful tribute to him. So
yeah,
thank you for to talk a little bit about what you wanted to communicate about John with this.
Well, I played a lot with John. He was in my group with Steve Smith for about 5 years. And then he was in the group that John Stoll and I had together for, you know, about 10 years, you know, so with Jason Lewis. And so I played, and a lot, and he was on the Billy Collins project. John's been on a lot of my important stuff. We did a tour with Dave Lieben and Steve Smith with him. And John was completely ego-free, but he also never played like, he played beautifully, but he never played like a wimp.
Yeah.
He always played strong, you know, and he always played what made sense musically. He was always musically appropriate, and it was always about the music for him. Of course, he and Jason sounded great together. He sounded great with anybody. He really did. And, you know, we got to be, I think, decent friends. I mean, he and I came from very different places, but by the end, I think we really enjoyed and respected each other. And I think that I always loved what he brought. You know, it's so funny, we just finished doing another week-long advanced intensive at the jazz school, and John had done those until he passed, and his presence is so missed. So I had a little advance notice of what was going on with him, that he was passing. And so when he passed, there was a song that we used to play together, Shiflett song, called Quantum Theory, which was like a real burner, up-tempo thing. And so I thought John had a great sense of humor, and he would appreciate the joke in his own way. He would appreciate it if I turned it into a slow, beautiful ballad, that melody. And so I kind of took that thing and turned it into my own thing, and it's like based on quantum theory, but it's also, you know, I'm not religious, but in my culture's tradition, you sit Shiva for somebody when they pass. And so this was, in a sense, musical Shiva for Shiflett. And that's the story behind that. And yeah, again, it was a small group tune. We played it at his memorial at Stritch. And then I expanded it up for big band and recorded it. I think Eric's also recorded it with ESO. And so, and Dan Fisley plays beautifully on it. I think he does. I think John would like what Dan does on it. And I'm not a big guy for doing doubles. I kind of feel like, hey, saxophone's hard enough. Why are you asking us to, you know, go ask your trumpet players to play French horn now, you know? But on this one, it kind of made sense to have some flutes and clarinets on it for the delicacy behind the bass solo, you know? And yeah, it's just an homage to a guy who is sorely missed. I mean, he's left a gaping wound. I mean, obviously nothing compares to what his wife is going through and all of that. But for those of us who played with him, he has literally been irreplaceable.
Yeah.
And so we all think about him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you did, being down at that festival last weekend.
Absolutely. Yeah. All the time. I mean, it's just, he was part of so many of the groups that have sort of, to me, like, or relationships, you know, with Jason, with Scott Amendola, that are just sort of like, oh, this is, you know, what the music sounds like for me here. It's
I always like to know, you know, when we would have these, when he was very unguarded off the record, to hear, you know, what his real thoughts were on something, because he was pretty diplomatic, but yeah, he was he knew what time it was. Yeah, he totally knew what time it was. Yeah, he was great. And he and his wife had a true love affair for the 41 years they were together. It was very beautiful. You know, he told me that the best decision he ever made in his life was asking Bethany to dance.
So the Sgt. Pepper's arrangement, how much did that evolve from the the Undercover Presents?
Or? No, not really. It was it was pretty much the same arrangement. I really, the only thing I did was I gave the sax solo to Dan instead of me, so that he could tear it up to his Lenny Pickett thing on it, and it's basically the same arrangement. I'm a huge Beatles fan. Hell, we named our son Macklin after, so it's and that, you know, it wasn't necessarily my favorite Beatles song ever, but I said, well, what can we do with this? And I thought it was kind of fun. This is not brain surgery, this is not rocket science, but it's an opportunity to feature Jeff Massanari just shredding it on the guitar, and he's killer in that situation. You know, I think the whole rhythm section and the fun, the trading between Jeff and Dan, it's really fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
I love that featuring Jeff Massanari, because he is such a fantastic player.
He really is.
And he's one of these guys who, you know, I think this is 10, 15 years ago, he was playing at Monterey Jazz Festival, and I'm standing at the back of the garden stage, and Bill Charlap's there, and he's like, he's supposed to go to like something else, but he's like just in there, just like digging it and loving it. You know, it's that world he lives in, you know. Great jazz player, but can do
great rock player. Great
rock
fun
player. Yeah,
to me, he and Dave McNabb are kind of like
two
of the same. They're both truly great guitar players. And there's, you know, you everywhere you go in the country, you go into a scene, you go, why is that guy not famous?
Yeah,
and that Jeff is one of those guys.
Yeah,
he's just a killer.
Yeah. Tell me about St. Paul. This is, again, we're going back to originals.
Yeah,
the originals,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and this
is
your. Hat tip to
Desmond.
Paul Desmond.
And sort of, again, the first three notes of Emily, you know, or what started it. And yeah, it's a nice piece. I like it. And I really wanted to feature Larry Delacruz with the big band. I love the way Larry plays, and I feel he's another guy who does not, he's so modest and unassuming, he doesn't get enough credit. I mean, you know, he's not in most people's conversations, but he should be, you know. And I just thought, you know, even in Squeezebox, sometimes he doesn't, I mean, Eric does his best to be democratic, but just he doesn't necessarily get as much space as I think he should.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to write something
mm-hmm.
for him. And I thought he would sound beautiful on it, and he does. It's, he sounds fantastic on it.
He is a tremendous player. That's lovely to... feature him that way.
He really did everything I thought he would do on that and more. It was great.
Something I think, but let's touch on that we were sort of talking about before we started rolling, was how you went about recording this music, particularly the Bay Area side of this, and just that. Sort of doing it old school with
old school.
The horns all together in a room.
Not just the horns, the entire band.
Entire band.
Yeah, yeah.
Listening to it.
Because the way most people record big band is they put the horns all in the same room, baffled off from each other. So and then the piano and the bass and drums, or the piano, bass and drums and guitar, are all isolated.
Yeah.
So basically, what you're doing is you have this wall of horn sound around you. And then you have headphones, and you put one headphone on, and you try to dial in the rhythm section into this one headphone. It's very unnatural.
Yeah.
And so I had done like four or five big band recordings in a row that way, and I just felt, man, I just think there's a better way. And so, you know, and look, there's no studio in the world that I'm aware of, maybe you go to Skywalker, who knows, where you can have like 18 different isolation rooms.
Yeah.
That would be one way to do it. But the other way to do it is just old school. Like they made all those great records. Just put everybody in the same room, facing each other in a square, make everybody listen and balance. No headphones. You get really good directional microphones nowadays, so you get the best of both worlds. So that's what we had done with the very first Electric Squeezebox Orchestra record. And I really liked it. I thought, this is great. And I really so decided that, and we had done it the modern traditional way at the Bunker, which is a great studio in New York. But I thought, you know, let me, for this one, Jeff Kressman had done the engineering for that original electric squeeze box with everybody in the same room. He's a fantastic engineer and a fantastic trombone player. And I just said, Jeff, can we do this? And he said, sure. And so that's what we did. So this is like they used to record all the bands. Mm-hmm. You remember, even back to Sinatra stood among the orchestra singing, yeah, right. You know, and there were no headphones. There was no baffling. It was just everybody listened and set a balance. So like, rather than asking the engineer to reconstruct the balance after the fact from scratch, you at least have a good fighting chance doing it that way. And the two CDs, not only the East Coast West Coast, they have very different sonic sounds. I think they both sound really good, but I think like the East Coast one sounds like a more what we're used to with a modern big band sound, and the West Coast one sounds like what you would have listened to with the Ellington band in the 50s or Thad and Mel, things like that, back before they isolated everybody.
Yeah.
And you know, by the time we got into the 70s, they just couldn't wait to isolate everybody. They, you know, and I remember some really great jazz records that were kind of ruined by some over isolation. They remember they got so infatuated with doing direct inputs for the bass and the whole thing. And it's too bad.
Yeah.
Too bad, because I think that they because they could, they did.
Right. And it was not like it was broken. I mean, they had figured out how to record things beautifully.
Rudy Van Gelder had a really good sound. And I think one thing that really struck me was when they had the pictures of the Train group recording for that unreleased stuff that just came out, the Both Directions thing, and you go, oh yeah. They're all in the same room. Train's right beside McCoy.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this is not something that can't be done.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. And it's both, when you think of it, it's both the, of course, the sonically listening and that. It's also the
right eye contact.
Eye contact, yeah. Just being able to, the most basic thing.
Just even like if in the moment you want to open it up and you can signal to each other silently, open it up. Mm-hmm. You can do that. You can't really do that if you're in separate rooms being ISO'd.
Yeah. Well, Mike, this is great. It's so fun talking to you about this.
You too. Thanks.
And congratulations on a fantastic project.
Well, thank you. I hope that you know that some folks enjoy it, and this kind of like I have this sort of bucket list of projects I want to do before I shuffle off this mortal coil, and this was definitely one of them. And like I say, I'm an unlikely person to put out a record of my big band writing because I've probably maybe done 25 big band arrangements my entire life out of 3,000 tunes. But I think they came out pretty well, and I'm so grateful to all the good musicians and engineers who were involved in it. You know?
Fantastic.
Well, thank you.